Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming out. Welcome. My name is Dubs Weinblatt. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. And I'm so excited to be here for our sixth season of the Thank You for Coming Out podcast. In 2015, I founded the queer improv show, Thank You for Coming Out, or TIFCO, as we call it. And it is now one of the longest running queer improv shows in New York City. During the show, our storytellers share their coming out stories, and then our improvisers bring them to life. Our podcast is a little different. We still have a storyteller share their stories, but instead of folks improvising, we talk about them. And I am truly honored and tickled about my guest here with me today, Rev Micah Busey. They, them, is a radical faith leader, a flaming fairy, and an enthusiastic fan who loves to extravagantly celebrate ever-evolving queerness, open-hearted spirituality, fierce justice-making, and unfettered co-creativity. Micah serves as the senior minister of New York City's Judson Church and as the artistic director of Judson Commons, is the author of the Book of Tiny Prayer, and is constantly available to discuss the prophetic potential of art, particularly when the conversation pertains to Dolly Parton, David Bowie, Mr. Rogers, Mavis Staples, John Waters, Grace Jones, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Hirokazu Koreeda. Did I say that right? Did I do that right? Okay, I'm getting the nod. Alice Munro, James Baldwin, Doctor Who, Pedro Almodovar, Lana Del Rey, and whatever movie they've just seen. Micah, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to come out to you.
Yes, I'm so excited for you to come out to me and to get to be in conversation with you again. And I just... For those of you who can't see, which are none of you, Micah is just smiling and is such an lovely way to like be at work. We're just having like someone smile at you and nodding affirmatively. It's amazing. How are you? What's new?
I'm well. I was talking with my therapist a couple of weeks ago, and my therapist was like, "Why are you smiling right now?" And I was like, I don't know. I think I just have resting kind face. So I feel like it's just a natural place where my face sits. So I'm doing well. And there are so many things I feel like to smile about, you know, about getting to be in this space with you. I'm a big fan of the work that you do, of the podcast. And I think that these stories are more important than ever. So the fact that I get to share this story with you today and, you know, be in conversation about it, it gives me hope. So what's not to smile about?
Amen. So you know that how there's, I know there's like some science, don't, no one quote me on this, but I know that there's like, I think there's science behind smiling and how it affects your demeanor, affects your mood. Do you find because you have resting kind face that your demeanor and mood are slightly elevated at all times?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's always a balance, right? I feel like this dovetails with probably elements of the story that we'll get into momentarily, but I have, as I've grown into being a queer adult, I have had to really, you know, through very good therapy, very good spiritual direction, very good, very blunt friends, kind of figure out like, what is a habit that I've built around smiling and kind of being joyful? And what is genuinely smiling? What is genuinely like leaning into joy? And I feel like in the middle of those two things is kind of where I'm always hovering, because I do think that part of my, you know, I grew up and then came out as the child of a preacher man in Northeast Ohio. And in Northeast Ohio, when you are a weird queer little kid who doesn't have any queer models and you're being bullied all the time, one choice is to try to be the kindest person that you can imagine. And I know that I did that at some point. I call it my glitter crust, that I created this armor around myself where I thought, okay, I'm going to get back at the bullies by being the smiliest, kindest, most empathetic person that I can imagine. And that's the way that I'll fight back against this bullying. So now as an adult, when I'm not being bullied every day, it is a habit for me to lean into smiling. And I always, it's nice to have the smile pointed out, because then I have to have a moment where I think, okay, it's a genuine smile. And 99.999% of the time, it is a genuine smile, but it's nice to be reminded, like, okay, why are you smiling? Why are you leaning into joy right now? And it was nice to be reminded of the fact that I'm just happy to be here. That's why I'm smiling.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love all that, and I can't wait to get into your story, and also Ohio, which I already knew. Which I'm wearing.
Oh, yeah, I'm wearing my,
exactly, wearing my Ohio shirt on your in your honor. So not only is it like I would imagine, like, I'm going to put words in your mouth and feel free to take them out, but like the reminder of like why you're smiling, but also the impact you have on people when you smile. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like that chain, because I'm thinking from my own perspective of like, if I'm walking down the street with, I have notoriously not resting kind face, and I'm like always grumpy. Yeah. I have a friend who like was like, there's a joke that I'm just like Peppermint Patty, because I'm just like always just like harumphing. And so there is a real difference when I am trying to be more intentional about my face and how I'm interacting with people. This is like a duh, but also the impact is so much different when you're being kinder to people than when you're not. And so, that's incredible that you've turned that into like a practice of using and leaning into joy as a way to move through the world.
Absolutely. And I think I love that you have just characterized it as a practice, because that's what I was intending to say without saying it. Like, I have decided that, okay, if smiling is going to be a habit for me, then why not add attention and intention to it? And then it becomes a practice, right? The habit plus attention and intention, I think, is what creates the practice. And so I'm grateful to not just be kind of, you know, lazily leaning into a habit, but instead challenging myself to make it a practice. And I think of that as, you know, as queering myself each day too, in a world that is so difficult, is so hard, where so many things and so many horrors are just still existing, where, you know, we're having all these rights rolled back, all of this horrible stuff. The idea to lean into joy, but also make that a fierce joy, and be like, okay, this is not a turning away from those horrors. This is actually like fighting back joyfully. That to me is actually, I would call that a queering myself too, because the status quo doesn't want you to do that. So then you got to queer that. And That's part of the smiling too. I didn't know we were going to spend like minutes talking about smiling. I love this.
That's the beauty of this podcast. We go wherever the wind blows us. And yeah, it's amazing. But I do want to invite you to share a coming out or coming into self story with us. And I am here to hold space for it. And I also do want to go back to your glitter crust. I will not forget about that, because I have questions. But first, I invite you to share a story with us.
Sure. And how far back should I go? I mean, So as I said, Northeast Ohio, just, you know, only child of a pastor and a teacher who eventually divorced when I was four. So I gained more family. I have a sister and a brother from my father's second marriage who I dearly love and, you know, want to call my sister and brother instead of calling them half sister and brother, because we're so close. But really, you know, growing up in Northeast Ohio, my context was church. I I was regularly bullied at school from an extremely early age. When I first started going to preschool, even without having any model for what it was to live a gay life, I knew that I was a queer being in who didn't really fit into molds that I saw around me. But the place where I was really radically accepted, and I know that this is maybe going to floor some people, it floors me every time I say it, but the place where I was radically accepted was church. And again, like this is a place where there isn't a lot of context, a time where there wasn't a lot of context for really thinking like, oh, this 4-year-old, this 5-year-old is really weird, so they must be gay. But I do think that there definitely was a from an early age, I was constantly coming out, right? Like I think, it's special for us, I think, to share these stories of about kind of really, really like revelatory coming out moments. And I certainly had those, but I would actually call my coming out more of kind of this like years long unfolding of layers where I was constantly in moments when I found out that I could trust someone in a moment, I would come out in a little way. So a thing that I remember most, I think the first coming out moment that I remember is that I was probably about 4 years old. My mom was looking in the mirror in the bathroom. She was putting makeup on, and I was sitting on the toilet seat just watching her, which is what I loved doing. Just watching from a very early age, I loved watching femme people like feminize themselves. I just loved it. And so I was watching her, and I remember my mom turned to me and she said, "I love my little boy." And without missing a beat, I looked at her and I said, "Do you love your little girl too?" And without missing a beat, my mother said, "I love my little boy and I love my little girl." And I was her only child, right? So this is a woman in a moment who was being offered a coming out moment from her child, where without even knowing it, I was queering the space, and she was met with, like, what do I, like, this person, this child is telling me that they are something that, at least as far as I know from my mother's history, like, she had not been faced with before. But I like to think that my mother, in that moment, she felt the queerness available in the space and she queered herself. That she essentially came out as a different being, and she queered herself into understanding what her child needed in that moment. And so I think of that as kind of a coming out moment, right? It was still years, 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 years before I came out as gay. It was still years before I came out as anything else. It was probably even years before I really so baldly said something and so boldly, like, troubled gender. But I remember that moment so distinctly. And so then, to fast forward a bit, I didn't really get context for what it meant to be, to live life as an out gay person, until I came to New York City at 18. I came to New York City to go to Fordham University. Basically, I had a plan to go to college, study theater and theology, and immediately upon graduating from undergrad, go into seminary and become a minister. So that shows you like how deeply ingrained church was in my soul. And also, to reiterate, how I felt very connected to church. And I think it really was related to the fact that my church life was nothing but accepting, nothing but affirming, which I realize, and which I realize more and more and more as years go on, was far from everyone's experience at church. So I want to always honor that. But when I came to New York, I basically, for the first time, saw queer community. So I saw, like, I suddenly had context for this way of living, for this way of liberating oneself, for this way of connecting to community of people who were, as, you know, for lack of a better word, as weird as I had felt growing up. And so, unfortunately, at that moment, at 18, I pushed myself into queer community, made beautiful relationships that exist to this very day. But because of some societal things that had been really kind of hammered into my mind, not by church, not by my own church, but by just, you know, the society outside, I suddenly thought, okay, wait, if I'm going to embrace queer community, I've got to let go of church. I've got to let go of this thing that has hurt so many different people, and so many people in the LGBTQ community. So I, you know, just kind of dropped church, and I dropped the idea that I would be a minister. But the reason I'm giving all of this context is that after a few years, at age 20, I then came out to my mother. And, you know, I'm the generation that, like, came up right in the wake of the kind of acute AIDS crisis. So when I came out to my mom, the first thing she said to me was, be careful. And then she paused and she said, I love you. And so, you know, and we have had, we've had great talks about the fact that her first response in that moment was fear. Though her first response, when I completely, at 4 years old, demolished the idea of binary gender, her response was, you are this beautiful being, and I love every aspect of you. But I didn't come out to my father until I was probably about 22, 23, because, you know, by that time I had really ingrained in my own mind that him being a pastor would be a real problem for me coming out. But let me tell you something. When I finally came out to him, I remember exactly where we were sitting. I remember even, like, the smells and the feel of the air. I remember saying to him, you know, Dad, I think that I'm gay. And my dad said, thank you so much for catching up. I've been waiting for you. I've been reading books. I've been taking classes. I am ready for you to live your life. Now you be ready to live your life. And again, appreciating that that is not everybody, and even not many people's experience of first coming out to their parents, especially their pastor fathers. What an amazing couple of people. Because, like I illustrated with my mother, I feel like what my father was telling me was that he had spent time queering himself in preparation for me to come out to him. My father, like, prepared himself before I was even prepared to actually say something to him. And so, you know, as I talk about my coming out being a continual kind of unfolding of layers, I have been so blessed to have people in my life who did not have to welcome those layers. And at every single moment they did. And so the little glitter bow I'll tie on this for a second is to say that that's why I do what I do now. You know, you mentioned that I am Rev Micah Busey. I'm the pastor of a church. You know, clearly, to fast forward through a lot of history, you know, I went back to seminary. I now am the pastor of a very, very queer church in Greenwich Village. And the mandate that I truly feel like I have is to pay it forward. I have had such affirming, beautiful welcome, and I'd say celebration, from the straight people in my life, namely my straight parents, that I feel like it is my duty to be that person that people who don't have that experience in their life can come to and see a different way. And so, you know, again, you've heard me use queering and queer as a verb several times now, but that to me is an incredibly potent prayer for me each day, because I think of myself as being biologically gay. So I have come out as a gay person, but I am logically queer because the world needs people who are continually willing to queer themselves, to wake up each day and to say, that status quo, that box, that thing that I thought I was, that thing that the world, you know, told me I had to be, today is another opportunity to shift that and to open myself up to other voices, to harmonize with folks that I don't quite understand, and to constantly be queering myself as a verb, because it was modeled to me by my mother and father in those two, you know, extremely potent moments where I just saw them as like queer glitter beings in front of me. I thought like, oh my gosh, this is what actual like queer heaven on earth is. It's coming out to somebody even before you know how to articulate it and having them meet you right there, even if they literally have no idea what they're doing in the moment. Just have it be filled with empathy and celebration for who you are. So I know we have to talk about the glitter crust too. That's the shadow side. That's the kind of unfolding of the layers coming out story.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. And I just am holding so dearly just your experience and how you've used your experience to help other people. And that's very similar to what I do, but my experience was for sure not as glittery as yours. But on the spectrum of coming out and being received, definitely on the positive end. Mm-hmm. But a couple of things I want to pull on, and then we will go back to Glitter Crust, which is just this idea of you watching your mom put on makeup, because when you were sharing that story, it immediately transported me to watching my dad shave. Mm-hmm. And I remember my parents had the smallest bathroom. And so to be able to watch my dad shave, I had to stand in the doorway, which now that I'm saying out loud is whatever. That's another story for another day. But so I'd stand in the doorway and just watch him shave. And I don't know that I ever asked him if I could shave. I think I already knew inherently, and I'm talking like 3 and 4 also, that wouldn't have been okay to ask. I don't know how he would have responded, but I felt the shame before being shamed, if that makes sense. But it was so, I just loved watching him. It was magic to be like, wow, that's so cool. And also just like having the towel around his waist of like, cause that was such a different way than my mom and how she wore her towel. And, and then it also reminded me of another moment in preschool. And this was like one of my very first memories, where if you could imagine this, like sitting in the little chairs, but like turned around, and we were pretending they were motorcycles. And it was like me and a few friends, they were boys, they are boys, they're men now. I remember my teacher saying, little girls don't sit that way. And so only reprimanding me and talking to me. And I remember at first being really confused. It's like, why, what's happening here? And then her like reiterating, little girls don't sit that way, and really only shaming me. Mm-hmm. And it was such a confusing, hard moment for me of like, you're saying that I'm a girl, but I don't think that that's right. But I don't know how to talk about it. But then why can my friends do this thing? And I can't. And it just was like that, the Brené Brown, you know, like warm wash of shame that I never forgot. Which is, you know, really on the other end of the spectrum of your experience of you saying to your mom, and you love your little girl, and her meeting you exactly where you needed to be met is so spectacular. And I really hope and believe that the work that you're doing will like continue to shift into, to use your verb, queer, how we view and how we hold space for kids and adults who are trying to find themselves and to feel that acceptance. Because I also would like test my parents on like, well, what would you think about this? And I didn't always get the answer I wanted. And so that it's tough. It's tough.
No, absolutely. And I want to, you know, as I've been so rosy about my parents, which, you know, I think hopefully as evidenced is like well deserved, you know, and to this day, they are just, you know, they live separate lives from one another. But I just from all sides, I feel very affirmed, very celebrated. Thank God I had that. Thank the universe I had that. Thank whatever we want to thank that I had that, because it wasn't the same at school. So when I hear you describe your teacher saying that, right? That like there are flames that start to kind of like just start to scorch at my temples, because I just do you like how I just rephrased like a line from Clue? I don't know why I didn't just say the line from Clue. I was like, why didn't I just say flames on the side of my face? The like I it makes me so like start to be enraged, because how dare that teacher steal that from you? And I don't, for me, and it, not that it would be more acceptable coming from a parent, but there's something about it coming from a parent where I feel I can at least look and say, okay, there's fear there. There's something there, like empire, whatever, you know, heteropatriarchy has gotten inside them. And what they're feeling right there, right? When my mom said, be careful, there's fear. I feel like because of all of these layers that heteropatriarchal society puts on us, I at least have a moment of empathy where I can see that a parent's response is coming from a root of fear that their child will not like succeed, whatever that means. But how dare a teacher do that to someone else's child? And maybe the binary that I'm drawing is not even necessary, but you know, because God knows I want every parent to be as, you know, immediately queering and celebratory as mine were. But, you know, I had several teachers who did similar things to me, right? Like it was essentially, you know, maybe we can say that it was out of protection. Maybe it would, but I was bullied from the age of 4 to 18, and I never had a teacher step in and say anything about what, you know, to try to school the people who were actually bullying from a place of fear. It was always kind of like, well, why do you have to be that? Why do you have to be so much in this moment? So it makes me super sad when I hear about a teacher doing that. And I'm also aware that whenever I say something makes me sad, my therapist always like, Micah, did it make you sad or did it make you mad? And it made me mad. That's where my glitter crust has to go away. But I, you know, to go to the glitter crust, it has a lot to do with that kind of bullying and the experience in school, because I distinctly remember age 12 out on a playground, bullied incessantly, right? And what's the worst thing in the, you know, the mid 90s that you can say to somebody without even having any context? It's to tell a, you know, somebody who's presenting as a boy that they're gay, right? It's just like the, like, none of us had any idea what it meant. None of us had any idea what it actually, like, what we had nothing behind it. But I was told that I was gay several times a day, every day of school, right? For 6+ years. And I remember on the playground that day when I was in middle school, I like had this kind of, I don't even know, like a stroke of Machiavellian, like queer, just determination, where I said, I know how to dismantle this. I will become the kindest person that anyone has ever met. And that will be the way that I dismantle all of this. And so the good and the thing that I celebrate about that is that I really did lean into trying to be the most empathetic, compassionate person that I could. And that continues to this day. My pastoral identity is built around trying to meet people where they are, even when it feels like there's just horrible behavior like coming at me, to meet it and be like, I am strong enough. I have been supported enough. I am self-possessed enough to meet this person where they are and say, what are you telling me about yourself right now? I don't think everybody needs to do that. But in my experience, part of me giving back is to realize that we're all hurting so badly from all of the systems, all of the mess. And so I have the capacity, I feel, to meet somebody and be like, you're being a bully. You're acting pretty bad. Why are you doing this? Who are you? Tell me why you think you need to do this to belong. But the shadow part of that glitter crust was that I started to wear it like armor, and I forgot who I was beyond it. And so I do feel like as an adult now, I'm constantly shifting between like what, again, going back, like what is habit, what is practice? I think if it's just a habit, if being kind is just a habit, maybe you're not paying enough attention. If being kind is a practice, then that's an active thing. I think it's actually even a queer way of living in the world. And I would be interested in how that hits you, right? But I think of that as, to repeat myself, it is a in a world that keeps beating the already marginalized down, in a world where, I can still like walk out of my door and see people, bullying one another and read the paper and see like horrific violence across the board, right? On huge national levels, global levels, on interpersonal levels, very specific levels. To choose to still think like I am going to be kind in this world and not turn away from all of that, but also decide that there's actually radical, I'd even say revolutionary power in choosing joy in this world that in especially where humans keep kind of making a hot mess of it. That to me is the power of kind of still understanding the glitter crust and making a practice of it instead of just being a habit of saying like, okay, la-di-da, I'm going to turn away, not look at that horrible thing anymore, and instead disappear into, watching television or whatever. But I'm interested in term, especially because right now I'm in a lot of conversations, especially with older, particularly older gay and lesbian people in the orbit of my church, in the intersecting communities, where I think they're still kind of moving toward and trying to meet me with this kind of like queering as a verb and like this idea that like I actually think that if queering is a verb, it's available to everybody. I think it's modeled by the LGBTQ community because we haven't had a choice. It's modeled by it just by sheer force of willing ourselves to exist in the world. But I think that it's a gift that we give the world and we give other humans, where even if they are not, if they wouldn't put themselves under that, umbrella of an initialism, that it's available to them. I like to say like choose the Q, like queer yourself. It doesn't matter like who you love, what your gender is, what you do, like you're able to queer yourself. Like, and it happens in between people. But it's an ongoing conversation. It's fascinating because that word brings up so much stuff for people, right? And I'm lucky to say it was never a word that was used to bully me I had lots of other words bullying me, but so it's an it's interesting.
It is really interesting. I think about the verb queering probably daily because I am always, well, I'm always trying to queer spaces, and then I'm also trying to figure out kind of to, kind of circle back to what you're saying is like who gets to use the word. And I just came back from a conference where I'm on faculty where I teach camp counselors different skills and programming that they can bring back to camp. And one of my like specialty track, which is where it meets multiple days for the longest amount of time than any other session, was called creating community with a queer lens or something like that. Because I love alliteration.
Do keep it
But
coming.
I yeah so I so so this was open to people of all gender identities and sexual orientations. And their biggest question to me was like, what is a queer lens and what does it mean to queer a space? And I asked them what they thought it meant, and they just didn't know. And in this room, as far as I know, included both folks within and ally to the queer community. The way that I explained it to them is similar to how you were explaining it, is like kind of just like going against society. And I don't know that they love that in the sense of that I think they wanted it to be more specific. But I don't necessarily think that it is, but struggle is not the right word, but I do feel the tension between like is this a word that only the queer community should be able to use versus but the idea of queering something is to break out against the norm. And I love the way that you put it, which is the idea of queering something was modeled by queer people because we didn't have a choice. And it's also similar. I'm curious what you think about this too. The one example I can think of is like with Harry Styles and people being so upset with him for like wearing dresses and skirts and say that he's queer baiting. And ask 100 different queer people and you'll get 100 different responses, but I'm most interested in your response. But my thought is the whole point, at least in my mind, of queer people living their queer lives and queering spaces and queering and pushing boundaries is to make space for everybody. And so to give Harry, like, should Harry like say, I couldn't do this without, like honoring the queer people who, created that space? That's maybe in a different conversation. But like, I think it's great that Harry feels comfortable wearing a skirt. Or I feel great that there are some cisgender people who use they, them pronouns also, because that helps them. To me, of course, it depends on the person, but generally speaking, the people I've met who use it, it's because one set of gendered pronouns doesn't encompass all of who they are, even if they're cisgender. And so, and I know for sure that there are trans and non-binary people who hate and think it's transphobic that cis people use they, them pronouns. But I still am in the practice of believing that we are making space for everybody. And so I'm curious what you think about that.
Oh my goodness. Well, first of all, thank you for all of that. And I will probably be very clumsy in my answers, but that to me is very queer too. Like, first of all, when you first said that, the folks that you were trying to kind of define queer for them, that they weren't satisfied with it. It was like, well, welcome to queerness. Like that, it wants to slip out of your hands the moment that you think that you've caught it and the moment that you think that you are able to define it. So the paradox of that, I think, at least for me, is very important to keep in mind, and to celebrate actually. It's funny because I don't know that the word queerbaiting has ever come out of my mouth, right? So I want to say a few things, a few caveats as I, lean into what I'm about to say. First, I am very aware and, am also in the practice of trying to remain aware of the various privileges that I have, right? I am white presenting. I have various ways that I queer my look, right? But at the end of the day, if I wanted to, there are ways where, I could trouble this a little bit, but I could quote unquote pass, right? I could probably very much, especially in zones where they desperately want me to be a straight person, I could pass as a straight person, where they've kind of just completely forgotten that queerness exists, I could probably move in those spaces. So I want to be very, very upfront about the fact that that is something I'm aware of and try to stay aware of as I say the things I'm about to say. For me, though, I could be totally misusing the term queerbaiting, but for me, an example of actual queerbaiting would be and it's about to happen, right? We're almost at June 1st. Like all of the corporations are about to desperately try to get our dollars and especially try to get our allies' dollars, right? Like my dad will wear a rainbow thing like more often than I will. I don't even know that I own any rainbow things. I own a lot of unicorns, but I don't own any rainbow things. My dad loves a rainbow thing and like loves being out there and being an ally. These corporations love it, right? Because they find a way to capitalize on actual like queerness. I find that to be kind of like an example of queerbaiting that is kind of bringing capitalism, bringing empire, and trying to repackage what should be unpackageable. With Harry Styles, although I don't even know that Harry Styles' name has ever come out of my mouth either. But with Harry Styles, with this sort of like visible queering, and I'm not smart enough to kind of understand the marketing machine where people are sort of like, do this thing, you're going to sell, millions more records if this happens. So I'm perfectly willing to be wrong and or have the conversation about like exactly why it's queerbaiting. At the same time, I'm sort of like, well, here, and I think this is at least dovetails with what you're saying. Harry Styles doesn't have to do that, right? Like, I mean, this, in fact, I would argue that Harry Styles is opening himself up to much more criticism, perhaps from all sides, by doing it. And so for me, I tend to agree with you right there that the though it's modeled by LGBTQ people because we have had to do it just to live in the world. Like many of us, as I've noted, like I and other folks can pass. Certainly I think that the quote unquote gay marriage fight has like totally just left trans people and trans people of color and people just in the dust, right? These are things that we actually have to we need to atone for, I would actually argue. So I would argue that there's a way that as particularly white gay and lesbian people have normalized themselves in order to present and get like rights and get and be able to move in rooms, that makes queering oneself and making the decision to queer oneself, whether that be visibly, whether that be internally in your own mind and heart, whatever, that makes it all the more important that you do it. Because I mean, I'm seeing I'm in Greenwich Village. We've got all kinds of, extremely wealthy, extremely affluent, particularly white, gay male couples owning these beautiful homes in Greenwich Village. And what are they doing now? They want their streets quiet and they want like the queer kids on the street, like they'll call the cops on them. And it's like, wait a minute. Wait, you might be gay, but you're not queer. You might be gay, but you have completely unqueered yourself, and you've honestly kind of sold your queer soul to a version of a heteropatriarchal devil, quite honestly. I don't talk about the devil a lot either, but I feel like for me, queerbaiting, there, for me, it is more of a systemic and oftentimes depersonalized approach to packaging queerness and trying to gain money and gain other things from it, as opposed to what feel like ostensibly like playful personal choices from people who, as you were noting, maybe are cisgender and don't have to do these things, but feel a certain kind of freedom. Because I would argue that though I don't need it to be everybody's goal, I want everybody to feel as free as I do in my queerness. I would love everybody, no matter who you are, what you've done, what you think you had to be, what you still think you have to be. I want you to feel what it feels like when I am like deep in like the true fiery glitter of my queerness, which isn't every day. But when I touch it is the most beautiful, liberating experience that I've ever had. And I want everybody to feel that. Everyone. I don't want to hold on to it. And I say that with deep appreciation for the people who are fighting to survive, who can't even, so they don't even have the time or capacity to worry about whether the cisgender straight people like are getting on board with queerness, right? I take that very seriously, but I do think that it takes a choir of people. We're not all called to do the same thing. I think that my distinct role as somebody who is out in the way that I am to be offering this to all. I will also say Judson never had a pride flag outside until a year ago when I became the senior minister, right? And I had this person who I actually think is a wonderful person. I wouldn't even say that this person is fully straight. But they said to me, and universe bless them for feeling free enough to say this to me. But they said, sometimes when I see a pride flag, I think that it means straight people stay away. And I had this moment, right, where I was like, oh my gosh, what do I do with this? And thankfully, there was this very young Judson congregant there, and she turned to this person and said, oh, when I see a pride flag, it makes me think everybody is welcome. And I want to find the sweet spot between those two things, right? I think that it's very important for queer people to have places where they feel safe to be together and not worry about what everybody else, what the other folks are, where on the on board or off board or where on the spectrum they are in terms of their own queering. But I also want, I think that for me, the project is also for that freedom that I feel, the freedom that I see my queer kin feel, to be available to everybody, because I think it's gonna save the world.
I agree.
You'll let us.
Yeah, I mean, I think about that all the time too, of like the freedom within my queerness and the freedom that I feel of just like of just being so true to who I am and true to myself and true to what makes me feel good. Even though I had to fight everyone and everything, myself included, to get there. I just really I agree with you wholeheartedly that if we all could quote unquote queer ourselves and feel that, then it would change the world for sure. I'm thinking back just to there's another term for what you were referencing around corporations. Which is like pinkwashing or rainbow washing, which is that specific, like, we're gonna like show you our rainbows for this month so we get as many of your dollars as possible, but we don't care about the queer community outside of June. And I also, I don't know that I struggle with a lot of things, but like I obviously want corporations who are taking queer people's and straight people's money like off of our backs or however you want to say that, should take care of the queer community and their queer employees year round. But also like seeing rainbows everywhere, seeing people wear, I love how you said you don't own rainbows. Like most of my shit is rainbow. Like I like wear the
Love it.
flag like as much as I can.
Yeah.
Like it's so I try to find the balance of like don't use and pink wash the queer community, but also how special it is for especially queer youth. But also, even me still, I'm like, I love seeing a rainbow flag anywhere I go. And I love seeing, whatever it might be. And so there's always that balance and that tension too that I feel. But it can be, I also am just thinking about what you said about like this like the older like cis gay and lesbian folks who have like sold their soul. And it just the word that came up for me there is assimilation. And it's like, how can I get as close to the ruling class as possible? Like as a form of protection. And so similar to what you were saying about, having like a moment of empathy, but then it's also like, do you know who Dylan Marin is? He says empathy is not endorsement, which I think about all the time of like, yeah, I can see where you're coming from, but I don't necessarily agree with it. Anyways, now I'm just rambling because I got excited
No,
about all the things you said.
I love it. I love it. I love it. And pink washing and rainbow washing, that was absolutely like the term that I had like archived in my brain. So I appreciate you pointing that out. And also, don't get me wrong, I have the equivalent of rainbows all over. I mean, I got unicorns, I got glitter all over my nails. Rainbow is, I think, an incredibly like seeing it. And actually, I'd even say, my partner and I, we sometimes watch, like basically shows and things where essentially the narrative can even seem a bit it like the narrative can seem a bit like it is a little bit too easy for making like and certainly I watch a lot of film and what I love like complex narratives and so but I feel like there are so many things out there including like what you just named in terms of the like just seeing rainbow in different places, like watching, things where I know there are complicated layers to even RuPaul's Drag Race, right? But you watch it and RuPaul's Drag Race, I don't even know that that show is necessarily targeted for me anymore. And my husband and I, my partner and I, we watch the show and we're sort of like, okay, wow, they're like really hammering home like how important drag queens are. They're really hammering home like, what like all these things. And I think, oh my gosh, if I were watching this and I was 8 years old in, in a town where, I had not yet encountered this, like this would be sacred text to me. This would be literally seeing God. And that to me, I at least tie that a bit into what I was hearing you say in terms of like, there's power in rainbow being everywhere. There's power in this. And I think that queerness invites us into that constant flux of like, where's assimilation happening? Where's pink washing happening? Where's queer baiting happening? And isn't it amazing that we are in this place where I at least know that there are places where people can go to and they can see it on TV. They can see it where even if the road is going to be hard and it is for so many, they can get to, they see that there are other people at the end of that road who will be there to be their queer family. And so that visibility balanced with like refusal to assimilate, I think it is a constant kind of verb and movement for me.
I could talk about this all day if you let me.
Well, I'm clearly ready to talk about it with you forever.
I want to, there's so much more I want to talk to you about, but I want to be mindful of time. I want to, talk to you about the overlap of theology and theater, and in some interviews that I listened to you, like to in preparation and things that I've read, just your affinity with storytelling, and would just want to hear from you, like how does storytelling and theology and theater, how do those overlap and how do those impact your life?
Yeah, I mean, I've said, before in lots of different venues that I think of church as performance art. I think of, Sunday morning service or, whatever the variety of services are, of course, because I'm a minister ordained in the Christian tradition. We have service on Sunday morning at 11, but whatever, analogous thing there is in another faith tradition. I think of those moments as opportunities to come together, to share stories, to gather around not only sacred texts from ancient times, but to treat one another as if you are sacred texts, to not only be understood, but to try to understand one another. I love that you brought up Dylan Maron saying empathy is not endorsement, right? This is telling stories, understanding stories, exegeting, that fancy word from seminary that is basically like a close read of a text, like closely reading someone within your capacity, right? And not denying that it's often very hard to closely read some folks, especially ones that are calling for your identity to be denied or your life to be taken. That basically in a church community, I have found that if you can build enough trust, that it's all kind of it's theater and storytelling. It's basically trying to find yourself within one another's stories, and invite other people to find themselves in your story. Even what you're doing here with your podcast, right? You might not call it a ministry, but I would call it a ministry. I think you're inviting a certain kind of dialogic sermon, even. You've let me go on and talk for minutes on end, but with each time that you have, moved in, you have not only kind of kept the conversation going, but you have affirmed that you're listening to me, and you've invited me to both like clarify things that I've been saying. You've invited me to think differently about the things that I've been saying. You've invited me to find myself inside snippets of your story that you are sharing in response to me sharing my story. That is church to me. That is actually, it's in the in-between space, that actual theology happens. I don't need for us to be using the word God to know that there's something spiritual happening between us because you asked me to tell my coming out story. And then when I told my coming out story, you shared aspects of your coming out story. And I think in that storytelling, there we create divinity. We create sacred texts of one another that will continue to reverberate and bump up against one another forever. And so for me, when I gather with my, little congregation on Sunday mornings, I think of it as an hour where I try to open up various windows. We do it with a song that we're singing. We do it with, Reading from sacred text, we do it when I kind of step up and talk for 15 minutes and do a sermon. But each one of these things is a window into an opportunity to get to know yourself and one another better. I think there are, as I said, I think of this podcast as being a version of church, but I think that there is still power in coming together and doing it as a larger community. I've gone, for over an hour without bringing up Jesus, which is very on brand for me. But in the interest of at least like bringing up Jesus, I think of Jesus as a queer person. I think of Jesus as, whether or not, none of us know who Jesus actually was, right? But we get versions of Jesus in all of these different sacred texts. And the person I read about is basically somebody who is telling really queer stories, which we call parables, but telling really queer stories just to disorient the violence, disorient the extractivism, disorient the empire mindedness of the world around him, and essentially invite people into a different way of thinking, a different way of being. And I think that every time we get together in church, we are recreating those moments, and we are being invited into queering ourselves past the boxes that all of those systems still try to this day to box us into and corner us into.
Jesus was the original queering of spaces,
Absolutely.
queering of stories.
Absolutely.
And something else that stuck out to me, well, first of all, that was such a beautiful way to describe this experience of this podcast. Thank you for that gift. It is a true gift and honor and privilege to get to be in conversation with folks. And it really is like, I can't reiterate enough what an honor it is that people trust me to come on and share. So thank you for that.
It's a queer thing to witness one another and to be witnessed, right? Because we were actually being witnessed, truly witnessed. And if we were always witnessing one another, then these systems actually can't stand a chance. These systems keep us pegged down. They don't stand a chance with a society that's actually allowing themselves to be seen and actually committing to constantly seeing one another. And that's what your podcast is doing.
I retire. Just kidding. The other thing that I just wanted to pull out, because it really resonated and struck me, which is you said the in-between space is where the theology happens. And to me, that feels like non-binariness or also queerness of like it's not this or this, but it's the actual like connection is what is like the quote unquote meat of the thing. A rabbi friend of mine, Ariella Rosen, I invited her to speak at a conference, and she talked about how there is a like something from the Talmud or the Mishnah or something about this, but it was the first I'd ever heard it was from her about how we all talk about night and day, but there's also dusk and dawn, and that in between time are a lot of times the most sacred, and was alluding to non-binariness. And so I think that even just among different religions and ways of thinking of things, that in between is where the magic happens, quote unquote.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if we would allow ourselves to be in that in-between space, which, to bring this full circle, I feel like the opportunity that I didn't even know I was asking for, but that my mother created in that moment back in the bathroom, in the mid-80s, was basically a liminal space. It was an in-between space where it wasn't either or. It wasn't black or white. It wasn't kind of, well, to be very specific, like it wasn't male or female, right? It was like both and several truths at the same time, and all the things that, we can talk about. But I feel like queerness actually actually not only invites us, but it urges us to actually say, like, no, you can talk about these things, but you have to live in that in-between space. You have to actually be choosing the cue every day when you wake up, because you can be your, you know, I feel like each of us who also chooses the cue probably identifies with one of the other letters in the initialism. But the cue, I feel like, is a thing that is constantly like asking you to do more work, to do more, to be more, to liberate yourself even more. And I think, you know, though church can be a huge messy thing, and certainly, you know, I spend a lot of time saying, I'm not that kind of minister. We're not that kind of church, you know, because, fundamentalism, evangelical fundamentalism, you know, all of these things like take up most of the sound waves, right? Like they're taking up the town square. So it is a blessing to them actually that I have to, every time now that I identify, and when you say Rev at the start of this podcast, somebody's like, oh God, what kind of Rev, right? Oh God, what kind of minister? I mean, I kind of trust Dub, so probably it's not a fundamentalist, but they've really captured the talking space. They take up all the air. So I've really been trying to lean into, what am I for? What am I? Because I feel like that causes so many of us, you know, so many of us to have to say, we're not that. I really want to know, like, what we are, what we're for. And I feel like queerness makes us keep leaning toward a horizon that is like, keep saying what you are. You're moving there right now. Keep saying what you are. So I'm very, very grateful to be having a conversation here that feels like it's calling me to continue to articulate things that still aren't clear to me yet, right? If I've had it figured out, then it wouldn't be a practice. It would be called a perfect. I don't have a perfect yet. That's why I got to practice it. But the continual storytelling, and especially meeting each other in the in-between liminal space, that to me is the closest I've gotten to feeling actual spirit, to feeling divinity. And it's queer people who really push that the most for me. And I'm really grateful.
Amen. I love that. What a beautiful place to, I'm going to say pause, because this conversation is not over, but it is for this episode.
Beautiful.
Thank you for
our services.
What'd you say?
At the end of our services at Judson, we say, this service is ending. Our service in the world continues. So I feel like this conversation just continues. We're taking a pause. We'll pick it back up. And that feels like that feels non-binary and queer as well.
I love that. I love that. All right. We have a lightning round of questions. It's meant to be for fun. It's meant to be silly. I was told in previous seasons that my questions were too binary, so they are open-ended, which might make it a little bit harder to do it quickly, but do your best. You can also pass. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. What is the name of your superhero alter ego?
Glitter Crust.
Love that. Where is your favorite place to think?
My office.
Who is an influential queer person in your life?
John Waters.
What is a song you can listen to on repeat forever?
The Light of a Clear Blue Morning by Dolly Parton.
Hmm. What does identity euphoria feel like to you?
It feels like telling somebody who I am and having them smile at me and say, that's exactly who they hoped I would be.
Oof. Yes. Ooh. Where do you find joy?
In conversations like this, and in the morning at 6 a.m. before anybody else gets up in the home.
That quiet time is nice. There was one binary question I simply could not get rid of, which is bagels or donuts?
Oh, wow. I'm going to go with donuts, but definitely like Donuts from Donut Pub in New York City. That's
The right answer was
Oh,
bagels,
I didn't realize there was a right answer.
there's not, there's not. This has been, oh, and also I second Donut Pub, but also Peter Pan. So
Oh, I
I
love those.
can.
Do you know what also though, what you can turn a bagel kind of into a donut? My partner Matt hates that I do this, but I call it dippin', and it is that I take a bagel and I pour a bunch of maple syrup into a cup and just dip the bagel into the maple syrup and eat it. So I don't know if I've just queered the binary question, but go dippin' and you've basically kind of made a donut.
Wow, you have queered it. I thought you were gonna say, that's why we shouldn't assume things, like putting like strawberry cream cheese on a bagel because then it's sweet, but that is taking it to a whole nother level that I
Totally.
am absolutely going to try and I'll report back to
Cannot wait. We will pick it back up.
you. Micah, this has been so lovely. Thank you so much for sharing all of your heart and your wisdom. Thank you for coming out.
Thank you. I feel so liberated, and I can't wait to keep the conversation going. Let's keep queering ourselves.
Let's do it.
Thank you for coming out.